So I sold my trumpet and I sold my motorcycle. DJs were planning to go on strike and I didn't want to be part of it. I was so excited, I was so high. This was unbelievable. It was fantastic for me.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which you hear from those who made a difference. David Jensen.
Well, I was born in Victoria, in British Columbia, on Vancouver Island. So I was born on an island in the Pacific. I was one of three children in the household. My mum was a registered nurse, and I have a sister who worked for the government liquor board. I never found out exactly what it was, but she went off to Italy for a while to work with the Todd Rundgren organization. But silly that I didn't know, but she was doing something and having a good time in Italy, so that was good. And then I've got a brother who became a policeman, who was a sergeant in the Vancouver Police Force, and he's 8 years younger than me. And we all sort of stick together, and my parents died some time ago. Pretty close family, as we are in the family, as I am with my current family. I was good at school in subjects I could that rely on memory, but I never really learned to learn, and that which I think school is about. And the difficult subjects are that you can't get by on a memory. So I got through school, and marks were decent just because I could memorize them. They'd ask me what the questions were 2 days later, and I wouldn't know what it was. So that is a major failing, I think, in that system. When I was supposed to be downstairs doing homework, I'd be listening to the radio downstairs, listening to the rock and roll of the era, which was the mid-50s. And I used to love listening to the radio from a very early age. I remember when Elvis Presley came to Vancouver once, and the town went crazy. And because I'd moved from Victoria to Vancouver when I was about two, the town just wasn't big enough for me. So I had to bust loose, and I went to Vancouver with my parents.
The big Cadillac drove up in front of the B section of the stadium and is now sitting there waiting for Elvis to come out of the dressing room. So all the lights are out in the stadium now and the car is just sitting there waiting.
And that was me dreaming of one day being a DJ, because I didn't think I'd ever make it in music. Having said that, I used to take piano lessons and I played trumpet in a school band and that kind of stuff. But what I really wanted to do was be a member of the Kinks or the Rolling Stones or the Beatles.
Noise is just a crowd on the west side where I'm now standing. I'm standing right at the dressing room.
I think of greenery. I think of going on drives, because that was a big thing in those days. If you had a car in the household, you know, you'd go for a drive. Here you wouldn't dream of it. You'd stay off the road by any means. But in those days it was quite good to go and do that and go to the various lakes that we have there, and in the winter go through snow resorts and things. So I think of the outdoors when I think of Canada. Perpetual rain, because it's the Manchester of Canada, they call it, because it's sort of a drizzle curtain of rain, soft rain that you get a lot of. But it's a beautiful, beautiful city. Well, I used to listen to lots and lots of music. My father was a jazz aficionado and had a great collection of jazz albums downstairs. He was kind of like a John Peel of the jazz world in Vancouver. He had a bit of a reputation in North America for pioneering new bands and new sounds, which at the time would have been from John Coltrane and Miles Davis and Sonny Rollins. And, you know, it was a golden era for jazz, that sort of early 60s. I shared a house with a bunch of guys who were in the same position as me, wondering what to do, knocking on the doors of garages, petrol garages, things, looking for pumping gas situations, and nothing ever came my way until I got this opportunity to work at an FM station, and that was through a scout leader that I used to go to years before, and he was a good radio DJ, and I asked him if any ideas or opportunities came up, and he said, "Don't worry, I'll think of you," and he did sometime later. In those days, radio was evolving into something that it hadn't been previously, which was something for everyone. The big pop rock stations were CKWX in Vancouver and CKLG.
From the north and the east and the west and the south, our news is news, not word of mouth. From the world of sports, top coverage too. Get it first, get it right by listening to CKWX Vancouver, CKWX.
And you'd have at 5 o'clock when I got my first job at a radio station in Kelowna in the interior of BC, doing the teen scene or something like that. That would be followed by, you know, country western music. And that, so it was like everybody, you know, you just stay with one radio station for your particular style or the stuff you loved best. You'd wait for it to come on. But then, as I said, radio changed at about that time to becoming one thing for all people, or for as many people as would listen. And so you'd have jazz stations, and you'd have classical music stations. And my first job was on a classical music station when I was 16. And I used to do this program playing baroque and chamber music on Saturday nights. And the show was sponsored by a funeral company called Day's Funeral Service of Kelowna. I used to play excerpts from Holt's Planet Suite, because I was pretty good at reading sleeve notes to make it sound as if I knew what I was talking about. And so I used to do that. And because it was sponsored by a funeral company, I used to say on air that, you know, that it was more like music for dying than music for dining. The DJs were considerably older than me. And the thing about being a DJ, you had to have a good voice in those days. Here, it's become less fashionable to talk with a kind of like a DJ voice, lower your voice with the pseudo-American sort of tones and that kind of stuff. But in those days, it was the voice was everything. And on your passport, I was a radio announcer. Different perceptions of what a DJ really was. And so I was an announcer. They wouldn't say a DJ. FM was, in those days, mainly for quality or classical music, as they would call it, and I was there as a junior doing things like Music for Dining, and I used to start asked to do read copy to record commercials, because in those days as well it was unusual for the presenters not to read their commercials. Day's Funeral Service, waiting to hear from you now.
It's about 1 a.m. in Vancouver on a Thursday morning, April the 11th, universally acclaimed Johann Bruno Shane. Playing them by request off the All Night Love Line with the number 3 song of 4 in a row by the Montanas, and You've Got to Be Loved. You gotta
remember, girl. We had what they called pots in those days. They were kind of like dials, like knobs that you'd rather than the sliding faders that we have so used to now. And it was really unusual, because people, when I went later into Europe, and they couldn't believe it, we didn't have headphones on, and the speakers were in the studio, and you could have them loud, and they wouldn't feed back or howl. I don't know how this was achieved, but and there was nothing on the air. The audience wouldn't think this sounds funny. It just sounded like it was quite a good sound, but there's nobody wore headphones. It was odd. I left that station in 67 when a DJ called Steve Young, who used to be a pirate DJ on Radio Caroline South, he came to work on the station I was on. And he had these scrapbooks full of pictures of these adoring girls, you know, with autograph books and pop clothing and DJs with famous people. But he also had the contact numbers and addresses. So I sent an audition tape, which is somewhere here, I think. I sent that to Mark White, who was the controller of BBC Radio, and to Radio Luxembourg. And Tony MacArthur, the Australian program director, as he was in the mid-60s. And they both came back to me. Mark White said that there were no opportunities now, but they were doing 15-minute shows, which is unheard of, because the minimum time that you do as an announcer on Canadian radio would be 4 hours, but you do these 15-minute programs, and I should stay in touch. Tony MacArthur at Radio Luxembourg sent me a telegram. In those days we had telegrams, saying if I could be over in 76 hours, the job is mine. Because they were looking for somebody new on Luxembourg. So I sold my trumpet and I sold my motorcycle. That gave me the necessary money to get on a plane and hot-foot it to London, where I got to meet the London staff and sort of, because I'd never been to Britain before, and to get to know a bit of London. So I came to London in 68. Yeah. I recall Carnaby Street, which was very cred in those days and very full of forward fashion. And I remember going to clubs, all the clubs in London that were popular at the time, where you'd see The Who. I saw The Who do their first performance of Quadrophenia. And I saw, Eric Clapton and Cream. And the nightclubs included places like the Whiskey a Go-Go, the Pheasantry, Bag of Nails, Scotch of St. James, Revolution. There were a few nightclubs that all had music and all reflecting that very exciting time. And did the first ever proper show, I suppose, was the Decca show, which I used to do. You'd play 60 seconds of a song. You'd announce the artist, you'd announce the publisher, you'd announce the serial number of the record. It was so strange listening to that now. I did that for about 3 months. And then I was invited to go to Luxembourg to work as a DJ in the sort of radio situation then, as we were familiar with it from America here and some of the pirates. And I really loved it.
208 musical meters of wonderful radio. And I hope this morning you are feeling fit and fine and wonderful and well. My name's Noel Edmonds, and you're listening to The Late Show, coming to you from the House of Decca. In about 20 or 25 minutes' time...
The DJs that I hooked up with in those days, Noel Edmonds was there, Tony Prince was there, Paul Bennett was there, Dave Christian, who's passed away now, was there, and Bob Stewart, who's passed away, who had that great voice, great American voice, even though he came from Liverpool. It was Paul Bennett in those days who used to call me Kid Jensen on the radio, and I used to think that was kind of cool. So he said, why don't you be Kid Jensen? Because there was another David, Dave Christian, so he said, you'd be the Kid. And Noel Edmonds said, what about the fetus? You could be Fetus Jensen. And I said, that's not going to scan very well. So I became Kid Jensen, and that's thanks to Paul Bennett, who gave me the nickname.
From trees in the rail pier on the shore, which is on the hot heavy 20 at number 17. It's called Sally. Free and easy. 11 before 2 in the morning. This is the big noise in Europe and around the world. Radio Luxembourg broadcasting to the world on 49.26 meters shortwave. VHF channel 6 and 33 to Western Germany. And to Great Britain on 208 meters in the medium wave band. Or
I was there for 7.5 years and really enjoyed it. And I ended up doing a late night program called Jensen's Dimensions, which reflected the kind of progressive radios that Tom Donahue in San Francisco used to do, which was to play album tracks. So that was unusual, because you'd never have the needles, the turntable set at 33 and a third, usually, championing people like Neil Young and Van Morrison and Joni Mitchell and The Doors and Jefferson Airplane, all kinds of people. They used to come to Luxembourg to be interviewed, and every now and then they would play. I'd get an artist who was keen to play at a local discotheque called The Blow Up, and the floors would clear and the recording equipment would go in, and we had loads of artists in those days that would come and play to get their music played on the radio. They would have live concerts. So I don't know who has the rights to those sort of recordings, but there's some fantastic music that's never been heard because they just disappeared. When you had Jimi Hendrix, you had Status Quo, you had the Grateful Dead, Beach Boys, I mean, loads of people that would come out and do these Genesis. They would make the effort. Queen. It was great. It was very exciting times for musicians and therefore DJs, because there were so few opportunities for presenters on radio in Europe in those days. So, but it was really a lot of luck that took me to where I was, and Tony MacArthur, who wanted me to be the North American voice on the station, if you like, and play that music.
Here's the news in brief at 2 o'clock this morning. Post office strikers go back to work in a few hours' time at the end of a 7-week stoppage. A British soldier died when fire destroyed a hut being used in an exercise in the Bavarian Alps. Mr. William Rogers, the Labour Party's aviation spokesman, warned...
A lot of people, as time has passed, think that I was one of the pirate DJs, but I wasn't. But we did have water surrounding us with this moat. Big chateau, basically, with a moat around it. Because the Germans, the Nazis, in the Second World War, used it as their headquarters and the record library for the English service of Radio Luxembourg, because there were other language services on the Great 208. So we had... A record library was the home of Goebbels. He used to go down there and record his propaganda on these huge metallic discs that we once had this unbelievable thing happen. We came in the afternoon, and there was a pile in the office that had been there forever of these metallic discs. Nobody cared about them. Nobody talked about them. The girl, one of the secretaries, wanted to have a clear out because they were just taking up space because there were so many. And one of the guys, Dave Christian, took a bunch home, and Paul Bennett took some home. And they turned out to be, you know, priceless, because they were the original discs that were playing these messages of propaganda beamed all over Europe and to the Allies. They'd be talking about, do you know where your wife is tonight? Do you know what she's doing? Do you know who she's with? All these really pointedly brutal sort of messages.
The great offensive against France had been brought to a victorious conclusion. The French had laid down arms, and throughout the world people wondered, when the final act, the offensive against British soil, would come. In Germany...
They all came from those studios in Luxembourg, and it turned out that the British Library, I think, ended up with most of them. But there was one very poignant interview that I remember. One of the discs had... A pilot who had been shot down, and underneath Radio Luxembourg there were also, there's so many things coming to mind now, underneath Radio Luxembourg there were these cells where the prisoners of war were kept, and there's lots of graffiti and carving in the bricks of soldiers that had been in there and how they marked their stay.
That's just about all the time we have for the gents, and have a look at a Friday night on 208. Stay tuned for Tony Prince, and have yourself a good Friday night, a good Saturday night. I'll be back with you again Sunday night.
People have subsequently told me that how powerful it was, but we didn't really think about it at the time. I know that in Poland, for example, a lot of people behind the Iron Curtain would be in touch with us, particularly the Poles, for some reason, them more than the others, but they would write letters to us because we were the voice of freedom. For them, that's what they say, that they listened to Luxembourg because it was a sound of freedom. And we used to get listeners, I mean, all over Europe and Eastern Europe, and unbelievable mail from Ireland. Just the volume of it. Yeah, well, it was really great. And it was really through the music I was playing more than anything else. We just consistently played, you know, the kind of music that they wanted to hear, which was the sort of music that no one else was playing at the time, but was still front page. Jim Morrison of The Doors said to me, "Hey, I met him at the Alouette Festival," and he said, "Somebody was saying that you work at Radio Luxembourg." And I said, "Yeah, that's right." He said, "Radio Luxembourg, that's a massive station." I said, "And you're on it all the time." And he said, "That's great." So he shared a beer with me. Who else said that? Had that at Radio Luxembourg? I can't think of it now. But so there was, the Grateful Dead. And they were only supposed to be there 2 or 3 days, and they did a live set for 5 hours when they were on. And we kept the transmitters burning through the night to accommodate them, and they wanted to do it. So we got good figures for that now, that program, I think, particularly in France, who really embraced that kind of music. Yeah, but they extended their visit because they had gone up to see the transmitters. They were particularly interested in that. And Jerry Garcia said, "Man, this is fantastic. This is far out." And I said, "Well, I'm glad you enjoy it." He said, "Oh, yeah, we're going to stay here another couple of days and to get more Luxembourg." And that meant their whole entourage, which were genuine Hell's Angels. I mean, the real deal. They were there with about 30 of them. And one of their players was tuning up his bass on stage before, about 5 minutes before they were about to go on. This kid in the crowd said, "Can you give this to Phil Lesh, who was the bass player?" And I said, "Sure." So I took 2 steps onto the stage, where I was scheduled to be minutes later to say, "Ladies and gentlemen, the Grateful Dead." But instead, I got on stage, and this Hell's Angel pulled a knife on me. He said, I can't repeat what he said, but it was along the lines of, "Where do you think you're going?" And then I heard this noise, click, and I looked down, and there's a switchblade knife at my stomach. I can't tell anyone because if I go and tell anybody, he'll get in trouble and he'll be after me even more. So I sort of like back down, and instead of doing this long thing about the Grateful Dead who formed in Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco and they'd been around X long time and all that kind of stuff, I just went on stage and it was just like, "Ladies and gentlemen, Grateful Dead." And I was out.
Radio Luxembourg welcomes the Grateful Dead.
I did start to get homesick. In fact, I've done this a couple of times since. But I wasn't homesick until I just got it really badly at one stage. So I went to Canada, and I stayed there for 2 months, and I came back, and it was fantastic. They put the message was up in Leicester Square, that news thing that they have, you know, with the lights going around with messages. Oh, it said, "Kid Jensen returns to 208. Because I had gone, another thing that happened in 69 was I was invited to take part in what they used to annually call the pop proms at the Royal Albert Hall. And on this particular bill, Led Zeppelin, who were a new band at the time, were playing. And there's a great poster somebody showed me once of the bill at that week at the Royal Albert Hall. It's got had in big letters, John Peel, Kid Jensen, and then in smaller letters, it's got Led Zeppelin. So I enjoyed that.
But I had to do all my programs in England. So these programmes were recorded and flown out.
People thought you were in Luxembourg, didn't they?
I think they did. It was a big bluff, really.
That was Muriel Young who put me on TV for the first time when I was invited to guest on a programme she was doing, which was kind of like a... Was it a talent programme? I can't remember the name of the show, but Donna was the host, and she was lovely. And Muriel Young, who was a bit of a legend in her time for being a very attractive presenter on TV, liked me and asked me if I would consider being a sole host of a program called 45, or Rock On with 45, I think it was just initially called, and then 45.
From the Shawadi Who, Shawadi Wadi!
And that was the era of the Bay City Rollers and David Bowie and Mark Bolan. That sort of pop. And those guys who used to come up on the British Rail trains with us, and they'd get off in Manchester, do the program, and then go back home the next morning. And it was quite a regular thing. And it was only later, when these guys became huge names, that I could really appreciate just how special that was in those days with those particular artists. PopQuest was a quiz, pop quiz program, which was initiated by Ian Bolt, sadly no longer here. He used to be the program director at Yorkshire TV. So I used to go to Leeds. So I'm still on the train, going up and down. The train from Luxembourg, I take the Luxair plane from Europe to Heathrow, and then I would get on the train, and, you know, I miss those slamming door trains and the marmalade for breakfast and all that. They used to run late, of course, and they had their own problems, but I have a romantic view. I used to spend so much time on the trains. So Pop Quest was something I did with Sally James, who was a co-host on that program.
Thank you. Well, today's show is a little different, to say the least, but just to make everybody feel right at home and at ease, we're going to start, as usual, with some climbers. Sally?
What was the name of the first single?
I know that there's a, you know, people don't really warm to people who are famous for being famous, but it meant that people were listening to Luxembourg, for example. It meant that, because when people come up to say hello, these days they'll say, where are you? And they can't find you anymore. But in those days, the people knew exactly where I was, and it was all friendly. People, and journalists would say, doesn't it bother you that people come up to you? And I said, I love it. I loved meeting the listeners. I said, in a way, it's like being a politician. You're only going to be successful if people like you. So, you know, I've never been one to be rude to anybody, because it just didn't, it's unnecessary. Won't you let me have a say? The music I most think of when I think of Radio Luxembourg, not just the music that I was kind of pumping out, but although I was playing Clifford T. Ward, but Gay, I love that song. That's a real, for me, Luxembourg song, because we used to play it. I'm sure other radio stations played it, but it just reminds me of that time, that particular, what was ever going on in those days is stuck with me, and so it was good. And another act that I remember well from those days would be Roxy Music. And they came to Luxembourg, and I was interviewing Brian Ferry. And Brian Ferry, in the middle of one of my questions, said, hey, could we stop just here for a minute? And I said, sure, what is it? And he reached in his bag that he had with him and took out a bottle of red wine. And he had the cork half open, so he popped the cork and poured it into a glass of paper cups he had. And he said, I've always wanted to do this. And I said, what? He said, lifted his glass and he said, here's looking at you, kid. It's a silly memory, but it's I met Gudrun in 1974 at a Luxembourg nightclub. It was Christmas Eve. She was on a layover, so she had a night stay in Luxembourg on her way to Chicago. And she used to be a flight attendant on Icelandair. And it used to be the cheapest way across the Atlantic. It was a forerunner of Freddie Laker's cheap flight from the United States to and from Britain. And she was going to university, and she'd taken a year out to be a flight attendant, because with it came a lot of glamour things to do and be in demand for some exciting trips. And the flight crews, I think, on many airlines in those days were regarded as rather special and used to get lots of perks with the job. But being a pilot in those days was quite a special thing. Now pilots are often thought of as bus drivers, because there's no specialness about being a passenger anymore on planes. Anyway, that's got nothing to do with Gudrun. So we met in 1974, and we only met a couple of times, but in February of that year, so 2 months later, I asked her if she'd marry me. And she said, well, how I said it, she usually loves telling this story, but I said to her, apparently, how do you say, will you marry me in Icelandic? And so she said, and he said, yes. And she said, she couldn't believe that that had happened, but happened it did. I then said she would go and buy the ring. So 45 years later, we're still together, even though we're not on speaking terms, because it usually finishes the story. But so 45 years, we stayed together, still together, and that's our anniversary coming up in June. She's been with me for the ups and downs, and it's been great. I left Luxembourg in 1975, having been there quite a long time, and looking for new challenges. I just got married. Radio 1 was all-powerful, all-conquering radio station. This is before the advent of the independent network. And I got the job because Doreen Davis and her husband, Derek Mills, who at the time was the controller of Radio 2, and she was one of the senior producers at Radio 1, she was doing on some sort of radio business. She was in Luxembourg, and she was keen on me as an announcer and or presenter or radio DJ, and she said to me, are you not interested in coming to Radio 1? I said, of course I'd love to come. And she said, well, I've got an idea. why don't you find a job in a commercial radio station here, which turned out to be Radio Trent in Nottingham. She said, because it occurs to me that you've been over here all this time, people know you, but you've never lived in Britain. You don't know what people are doing, the papers, the football, all this kind of stuff. It would be very important to be on Radio 1 to be able to connect with the listeners. It's very important to have that connection. And she says, I think you can do it, but I just think you need to have some experience of living in Britain. So I got a job at a station, Radio Trent, in Nottingham. A day before I was due to go on air there, Capital Radio, which had started by the year before they'd started, and they were a big station for London, of course, and Aidan Day, who was the program director, phoned and offered me a place because somebody was leaving. Can you be here tomorrow? I said, Aidan, I'd love to, but I've just taken this job at Radio Trent in Nottingham. He said, you sure you can't come on? And I said, no, I can't do it. And he said, well, good luck with Nottingham. And I said, thank you, and that was it.
Nash, David Crosby, from a feature album from last fall called Wind on the Water. That was Homeward Through the Haze, 13 after 12 o'clock. In downtown Nottingham, this is Radio Trent from Castlegate. More of that fine music, this time from the Eagles and from their greatest hits. Song about a peaceful, easy feeling.
The radio in Britain at the time, which was made up of just a few independent commercial radio stations, or ILR, which was independent local radio, were very, very different from the kind of radio I had been used to. Certainly not the radio that I was playing on Luxembourg, or the sort of radio that was styled in Canada and America. It relied on people who, I suppose, knew what they were doing, making unpopular choices in order to find their feet in town, because inevitably the local radio station that people all listened to and loved was their BBC local station. I mean, never was that more so than in Radio Nottingham, in Nottingham, of course, and versus Radio Trent. And all the media loved Radio Nottingham, and as did the listeners. But so Trent was very much started, when it began, was on the back foot. But slowly but surely, and it takes a lot of work to do this. You get a lot of time out of the station, a lot of time thinking about the station, being passionate about the station. I suppose the big change between radio styles then and later is the pace. Radio is a lot quicker than it was before, and people say things in a more succinct way, as opposed to speaking across the garden gate. Everything was a bit slow, but people were used to that. So you could talk slowly, and they'd like it, or you could talk quickly and think, I want to do a show that I would like to listen to.
Kid Jensen.
It's Kid Jensen. That's right. Kid Jensen. I play music, and we have race results, and we have what's to do, what's on in Nottingham for the evening, and we have lots of news and new records, things like that. It's me, Kid Jensen. That's right. Kid Jensen.
Yes, what's Kid Jensen. On Trent 301, afternoons, Monday to Friday, 2 to 5.30.
Kid Jensen. Music Radio 301.
There was a dispute, and I can't remember the name of the union that was involved in this. There was a dispute about the program director, a guy called Bob Snyder, and the management. And I, for the life of me, can't remember what the problem was.
There is some personal animosity between me and the managing director. It's difficult to define, as I suppose it always would have been. I was hired by the board of this company, not by Dennis Maitland.
In many senses, this is between Bob Snyder and myself, obviously. Nevertheless, since he is a member of ABAS, there is procedure that we must go through, which we are...
In those days, because I was doing contributions for the British newspapers, I went to see the Father of the Chapel, which you'll never hear that expression anymore, at the NUJ in Nottingham, and I said, where do I stand on this? Because DJs are planning to go on strike, and I didn't want to be part of it. And he said, well, as far as the NUJ is concerned, you're fine. And I said, oh, well, that's great. So it was a tough time getting to and from work, having my mail torn up, having all the things you might expect people to do in those situations, which become very kind of, people became hot-headed and very negative towards me. So I was really lucky when I got one of those magic phone calls again.
Electric Light Orchestra and Knight Rider, and that's about it for me. I've got to get out of here. Make way for the Trent Radio News team and the Newsbreak program, which is on for an hour, following this from Elton John, who's turned out to be the pinball wizard after all. I'll be back tomorrow afternoon with Martin Johnson, and that's for Saturday Sport. Have a good Friday. Good listening with Trent 301. From Kid Jensen, good love.
And I got home from doing the Drive Time show on Radio Trent, and I got a phone call from Derek Chinnery, the controller of Radio 1. And he said... Emperor Roscoe, who was one of the major names on Radio 1 at the time, was going back to America to be with his dad, who was not feeling very well. And would you like to take over his program? We give you a run of, say, 6 months and see how it goes. I didn't even think about the security or insecurity that a potential short run would give. I just said, yes, of course, I'd love to do it. He said, well, we'll talk about it. And I said, fantastic. And I put the phone down, and I could have run to London. I was so excited. I was so high. This was unbelievable. It was fantastic for me. And they gave me a show called Roundtable, which was a great record review program that I did on a Friday and had lots of guests.
A lot of music to get through, and a welcome to Kid Jensen making his debut performance.
That's right.
Hi. Nice to be with you again. We've been together before, though.
Yes, you have. You did it to me up north.
there was one particular episode of that program or that series that my guests were Michael Jackson and George Harrison. And it was great to get George Harrison because he was the quiet Beatle. He didn't do very much, but he came and did Roundtable, as did Michael Jackson. And Michael Jackson was really in good form, and they ended up talking to each other, which was perfect.
Did you guys always write your own stuff? I mean, from the beginning?
Yeah, well, John and Paul wrote right from before we ever made.
How did you ever
records?
Manage that?
I don't know. They were clever little fellas. But we did record.
So it was a great time for me to be there when I was thinking, if the gang in Kelowna, British Columbia, could see me now. I've got a good memory of Michael Jackson in that he was with his brothers doing a show at the Hammersmith Odeon some years later. And he invited me and Gudrun and about six or eight others. So there weren't that many people at this gathering. And so I felt quite special to be there. And I looked up, and he was teaching Gudrun, or trying to teach her, how to do the moonwalk on this shag pile carpet, which made it even more difficult. But that was happening just feet from me. And I also remember another point that happened at that little party. He came over and sat next to me, and he said, did you speak to Jermaine last week? And his brother, Jermaine, was indeed on the program the week before. So I said, yes, I did. What did he say about me? And I said, well, Michael, I can't remember exactly what he said, but it was complimentary. It wasn't critical in any way at all. Oh, that's nice. Thank you. And he got up and left. Yeah, so that was a bit of an insight, I suppose, into something. Actually, that reminds me of another story. It's some years before, so I'm going to rewind here a little bit. But I was invited to tour with the Rolling Stones in 1973 for their Exile on Main Street tour in America. It was because Mick Jagger wanted me to be on the plane and be part of the interview, so I was on their tour plane because the guy that ran the record label, Marshall Chess, who owned Chess Records, he didn't want me on the plane. And but I heard all this conversation on the plane that we were sitting in, and it wasn't like with the conventional seating arrangements. They were all over the place. It was, you know, it was in the wintertime. We went to and Bill Wyman gave me an access all areas pass, and he said, just I said, where can I watch you? He said, just behind me on stage, of course. So I was, and I've seen myself subsequently on a documentary on the Rolling Stones was on recently, and I looked and I thought, my God, that's me. And because the camera was just at that angle, seeing Mick Jagger, and there was Bill Wyman, and there was me, the spare part. But that night, we were in Pittsburgh, and we were going to get a plane to take us to New York the next day, or we were in Philadelphia to go to New York. And the plane was held up because we got frozen. It was very depths of winter. But somebody brought a football out on the runway, and they were having a kickabout. And one of them said, Kid, come and join us. And so that's when I really thought, wait till the gang can see me now, because I was playing football with the Rolling Stones at midnight in Philadelphia. It doesn't get more bizarre than that.
Good afternoon to you. It's the Kid here once again sitting in and messing around for DLT, who's out on the Radio 1 Roadshow. And I've got music I think you're going to love right through until 7 o'clock. Our featured studio guests tonight are Wales O'Regan. More about them in a moment. Right now, Boney M.
It was a very evocative place to be because everybody around the world knew about the BBC. And if you worked for the BBC, then you had to be quite special. It was that entrance, which was always reminded me of a big ship going down Portland Place. And it was you had commissioners, of course, at night in their uniforms and secret passages to here and there. And I used to, I loved it. I never, ever went through those doors without thinking I was going to something special, that it was an honor to go to be part of that. And working for some wonderful people. And the DJs at the time when I joined Radio 1 would have been Johnny Walker, Ann Nightingale, who'd been, I think she was probably the first female voice that I recall on Radio 1. And who else was there? Tony Blackburn, David Hamilton, John Peel. It was that, and Noel Edmonds. Yeah, it was a golden age. I mean, the DJs didn't really socialise with each other much because there was no time. They used to do lots of gigs. You'd come off air and you'd be on the road somewhere else. There were demands to do gigs, and they were very lucrative, which is the reason we did them. And occasionally they were great because they could be fun too, so that made them worthwhile. The DJs that you gravitate to as friends sort of evolves naturally. And I Paul Bennett, I worked with at Radio Luxembourg, and I worked with him at Capital, and we were at Radio 1 together. And he's a real gem in British broadcasting, very funny guy. And Paul Gambaccini. So I used to socialize with Gambo and John Peel, because Peel and I were very close friends, and I used to love working with him. He was a real, it was a wrench when I for me emotionally leaving Radio 1 when he was there, because he wanted to come with me to Capital. And he said to me once, you know, this is like a divorce. And I said, listen, we'll still see each other, we can do this. Because especially when we did Top of the Pops, that a lot of that was just ad-libbed, and he was very very kind to me in the early days when I was at Radio 1, when I didn't know people. And he was also very funny. He and John Walters had a devastating humour, very sardonic sort of way that they spoke, and I used to love their company.
Oh, I see. Well, that's right. Fair enough. OK, what's next then, Fatty?
Next, you're going to attempt to wind your way through the chart.
Right. Number 30, down at the tube station at midnight from the Jam.
In 1980, I got this offer to go to work for Ted Turner, who was a television maverick in many ways in America, and owned CNN and TBS, the Turner Broadcasting System.
God, what a day I've had. It's been a really emotional day. I didn't realize I had so many friends around here. And it'll be the last time that Kid Jensen takes to the airwaves as well.
That's right, because you will revert to your real name after this.
That's right. What is it again? I've forgotten.
It's David Allen?
Horatio?
Yes, that's right. Something Cod like Jensen?
Algernon? David Allen Jensen reigns from next week, but for now it's Kid Jensen.
They wanted me to be a news anchor. And this came about because the president of CBS Television in New York was in London, turned his hotel TV on in the morning, and there I was on the Open University talking about Heroes. It was a series that he called Heroes, and that particular one was about Martin Luther King, who I then got to meet his wife, because she used to regularly appear as a guest when I was doing the news. Coretta Scott King, her name was. I got really homesick then, and I remember this happened when I was sitting waiting to do. I was doing these news bulletins on a Saturday afternoon between the wrestling bouts and baseball, which TBS used to carry a lot of because they owned the Atlanta Braves and the Atlanta Chiefs. But I was sitting in this ring next to this wrestling ring where these guys were all dressed up. It was the advent of WWE and all that. So all these strange people. When somebody said, David, I looked up and said, some people to see you. And I looked and I walked over to where these, because I couldn't see in the lights who it was, and it was the police. Three members of the police. They were in Atlanta doing a gig that night. They came over to see me, and I was felt. And Sting said to me, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, it's stuff I like doing. I like the news, and I like." He said, "But do you belong in Britain? You shouldn't be here. You should be in Britain." And it's interesting he would say that because his mother used to write to me when I was on Radio 1 because I was playing championing the police, and so it was interesting that he made those comments. And he said, "You should come back to Britain." He said, from his penthouse in New York.
Young teacher, the subject of schoolgirl fantasy.
The next time I met somebody from Britain was in some weeks later, that was visiting me in Atlanta, was Doreen Davis and her husband Derek Mills. Derek Mills said to me, "We can't wait to get you on Radio 2. It's almost time for you to join us on Radio 2. And I said, "I'd be honored to do that someday." Doreen said to me, this is the second time we're having the same conversation, she said, "Are you enjoying life here?" She said, "I walk down the street, I don't see people looking at you as if you the way they would in Britain." And I said, "Well, I can't base my career on that." And she says, you only get one career." And so she always was a good woman for advice. And so I took her advice, which I was glad to, and got on a plane and came back to Britain to host Studio B15, which was like a music talk program, long forgotten, I think, on Sunday afternoons. And get my old drive time show that the evening sessions with took me back to with John Peel.
You going to speak or am I?
I was just thinking that one of my great hopes for 1984 is that the Clash are going to start recording again, because 83 was a fairly silent one, of course, with all the ructions of top.
I used to do a lot of TV work in the mid to late 80s, and there was one program that will always remain in my memory because it was a show in which Paul McCartney was involved, and I was the host of the show. And after the show, Paul McCartney met me in the car park, and he said, how you doing? I said, good. Whenever he sees me, he usually pulls what he thinks is a gun, or it looks like a gun, his hand, and goes, Kid Jensen, like I'm Billy the Kid kind of thing. And he said to me, do you mind me making some comments about some ideas that I have for you? And I said, no, go ahead. And he said, you know, I've seen you for years on TV, but I don't really know you. He said, I think you should talk about yourself more and relate to the people by doing that. He said, I think you'd have a great success. And he was right, because that's one thing that from Canada, you didn't want the presenter to say how his tomatoes were growing. You'd want him to just get on with it. But that definitely touched me, the fact that he was interested enough to tell me that. So that was really nice. And we used to spend time with Linda, his wife, who was fantastic. She was really a nice person. She would talk about energies everywhere and anywhere. And she was a nice person. And she always used to, when she'd see the kids, because they have similarly aged children, how they were doing, are they eating vegetarian food? And yeah, it was, so I've got good memories of them. We were invited once for a Sunday roast, which she cooked. And we went for a ride on some scooters and in the woods. And yeah, he's a lovely guy. Radio 1, Gold Show, the right sound. I think of Radio 1 and I think of the Radio 1 road shows, which were fantastic. I mean, if you couldn't wait to get the week's rota for the shows for the summer that Johnny Beerling would prepare. And so if you got Penzance or somewhere like that down in Cornwall or the West Country, you would be guaranteed thousands and thousands of people on the beach doing nothing more than watching you play records. It was a bizarre entertainment, but it worked. It just worked. And Johnny used to head those and was responsible for those, and getting us linked with things that were important to be linked with, like the Variety Club and charities, things we used to do. And we used to do these silly football games. Well, they were silly to those that didn't like football. I love football, so I used to fantasize like mad that I was playing with Crystal Palace or Manchester United, when in fact I was playing for the Radio 1 celebrity team. And we would go into the local town's team on a Sunday afternoon to play a game against the local people, and it didn't matter whether we lost or won. We rarely won. It was just such good fun, and the crowds were out there and really supporting everything we were doing, and Tony Blackburn and DLT larking about.
In London to chat on the program tonight is Morrissey, who's the lead singer of the Smiths. Hello, Morrissey.
Hello.
And welcome. You've come down from Manchester just for
I was enjoying it, but not as much as I probably would have wanted to, because I got to that feeling that, you know, I needed to move on, that things were great, but in long term, I thought that I should be somewhere else. And I got one of those magic phone calls from Capital Radio, similar to the one I'd had from Radio 1 all those years before, asking if it was from Tony Hale, head of music at Capital Radio in those days. And we used to work together on Radio 1, the road shows and other programs out of Manchester. And he wanted me to head up a new program they were going to do called the Network Chart Show. In fact, then it didn't have a name. But they wanted to put a chart program up against the BBC's chart program, and it was good. So that was the career reason for going to Capital. But the emotional reason for going to Capital is I just love listening to the station. I just loved it. It had so much personality then. It connected with London in a way that no other media was. It had some great DJs, and you felt like you were part of a team. You know, Radio 1, for all that we were on the same, we were wearing the same jackets and T-shirts, we weren't a team the way Capital was a team. But here it was that I could join the likes of Roger Scott, a brilliant DJ, Michael Aspel, who was on, Nicky Horn, David Rodigan with a weekend reggae show, which was essential listening. And I was so flattered to be part of that energy.
Breakaway, Beach Boys. Rolling Stones played in Hyde Park that July. Mick Taylor in place of Brian Jones, then Mick Jagger went off to Australia.
So I said, yes, I'd love to come. Desperate to come. It was, and that was much closer to the radio that I wanted to hear. If you're talking about pace and what have you, Capital in those days had it all with Kenny Everett, of course, and Dave Cash. Not many women on air, but that was certainly fixed years later when Lynn Parsons came to the radio station with her very warm and welcoming sound. And so it was nice.
Hi there, it's David Kid Jensen here with the very first Network Chart Show coming at you right across the nation on independent radio. Now, every Sunday afternoon from 5 till 7...
The chart show on that we were playing out on a Sunday also included Airplay, which, you know, the Billboard chart in America does. So the charts were compiled differently, rarely different number ones, but occasionally you'd have, certainly top three would be different. And I've subsequently spoken to many artists who would listen to the network chart. You know, they would say, oh, you used to listen to you on the network chart. And I was thinking, they could listen to the Radio 1 chart, but they're listening to the network chart. I took comfort from that, and also a surge of pride that, you know, it had worked. The great gamble had paid off, because the network chart didn't really have any TV backing. The Roxy came and went, which I hosted, but that was that didn't really take off the way that was supposed to. But so we did it. It was a radio success, because Radio 1 had the Top of the Pops and the vice versa.
Now taking their place this week, the very first chart busters of your network chart show. On our test runs, these discs didn't make the top 30, but they've sure busted the
we
chart today.
We used the Flying Eye, the airplane that did traffic reports in Drive Time and Breakfast, and we used to hop, and with a hop, skip, and a jump, we used to go to pretty well all the cities that carried the network chart. And it was fantastic to meet the program directors and the other people who had comments to make about what we were doing. We had one particular helpful comment from Belfast, from John Rossborough, who pointed out that we're using the expression with a bullet. This track, up nine places with a bullet, he said in Northern Ireland, that we would avoid that. I said, you're right, you're absolutely right, and I dropped it then. You know, some people might say it's oversensitive, but if you're in that situation, you have the right to, I think. Capital, for me, was what we did from 84 to 87. Those were golden times for Capital, with the various DJs with huge personalities, great voices, and a great sense of radio and love for the station. And it was a station with massive loyalty.
Well, events in Northern Ireland have taken a turn for the worse this evening. With the details, here's Richard Foster.
I left Capital for Heart 106.2, who were rivals with each other in those days. But I had faith in a fellow called Keith Pringle, who I knew as a technical operator at Capital Radio, who then became a producer, who then started working in New York Breakfast Radio. And so he knew what he was doing. And he invited me to join Heart to do this. And they had these plans for, you know, through Chris Wright, the owner of the station that was independently owned then. So they said they pushed all the right buttons, and I ended up pushing their buttons. But it was an interesting move for me. Francis Curry, who was a radio presenter in Coventry, was their kind of consultant head of programs. And one day I was doing my program, doing the Drive Time show on Heart, when I got a phone call from my agent, who was in the building, which I thought was a bit strange. I said, I'm with Francis. Can you come by his office on your way out? And I just knew the amber light flashing on the dashboard, that there's something up here. And it was the first time that I had been released from my program, that they weren't going to renew my contract, and it's got nothing to do with your style or you or your music. And I'm thinking, well, what has it got to do with then? But anyway, that was that. And because I always fancied myself not ever being in that situation, that I could always be, you know, call the shots to when I wanted to leave. You cope with it by being angry or channeling your energies into doing something completely different outside of radio. I could never do that. And I didn't want to stay angry for long. There's no reason to be angry at anything, really. But I think of the family, and because it is a trade, and I need to work. And so those are the things I was thinking of, not how I've fallen.
Capital Gold Genesis, who are set to release expanded versions of their biggest-selling albums later this year. Between them, Genesis, 1983, Invisible Touch, 86, We Can't Dance, 91. And Calling All Stations 97.
The Capital Gold that I went to next, it was trying to be, and often succeeded, at being WCBS in New York. The station was playing oldies. I always was critical of this, the music, because it was the same Elton John songs time after time. So there wasn't the variety, for example, that CBS New York would have. But I didn't feel a member of a team there. I didn't have that kind of love for for my situation then, but it was good to be, that somebody wanted me. When these things happen, they happen for a reason. So try to accentuate the positive, which is what I did for the most part.
Buddy Holly's Not Fade Away from the Rolling Stones from 1964. This is The Kid rolling out the greatest hits of all time. Next up, Rue Betts on Gold.
Life After Gold has been a merry-go-round of different formats that I've worked with, and always doing my best for the station, even though the audiences were much smaller, of course, than I was used to or had before. But nothing goes on forever. Life changes, and you look for your pleasures in other ways. And I'm hoping that my best work is yet to come. I mean, that sounds a bit cliched, perhaps, a little bit silly, but who knows? Unpredictable things can happen, and in my career, they have. There could be something still. BBC's Radio Sussex and Surrey, I've spent time there doing fill-ins and things, and I enjoy that. It's slower paced with lots of interviews, and I think they serve the public, the local public, very well with the things that they talk about, and it's not in a way that Capital had created this emotional connection, but in a way that the BBC local radio should. I sometimes listen to radio, local radio, and I think to myself, I'm hearing somebody that would rather be on another station, because their audiences are older than they are often, and so young people have got different things to talk about, and so I wonder why they don't all have an older presenter. There's nothing wrong with being old. I also regret the closure of the Jazz, because I was doing a daily program on that station, which played proper jazz music. It wasn't like watered down rhythm because it had a saxophone in it playing as jazz. It was proper jazz musicians, the likes of the people that I used to hear my father play the records of in the basement. So I then got to play Thelonious Monk and Louis Armstrong and some great people. I thought it did a real service for lovers of jazz, and lo and behold, I was on a train one day when this lady came up to me and she said, "I just want to say that I love your radio station." And I was thinking, "What show she means?" I said, which station? And she said, "The Jazz." I said, "You like it?" She says, "I listen every day." She said, "I love it." That was the moment I thought, I found myself. I'm playing music I know about. I'm playing music that I love. And there's a great pioneering spirit about it. But it was closed down, and that was it. So it was to be no more. And there are so few opportunities to doing jazz. I used to drag my feet along. Ever since I was a little kid, I've always been told to pick up my feet when I'm walking. But I was always a lazy walker. But as I was getting older, it was getting more pronounced. So I thought something's not quite right here. And I'd wake up in the morning and I'd stretch, and my whole body would sort of convulse. I then Googled it, of course, the first point of call, what is this? And the suggestion was it's a symptom of Parkinson's. Not necessarily, though, you get those symptoms with other diseases as well, but I went to the doctor who said to me, well, the good news is you don't have motor neuron disease and you don't have MS, but you do have Parkinson's. And he said, there's no cure for it, but the researchers are working all the time at trying to find something. When I was told, I was upset. I thought of my grandchildren. I've got seven. I thought that I wouldn't see them grow up. But I was told by the doctor that I still had a few years left. And people don't necessarily die of Parkinson's, but you die from not being able to swallow anymore or some of the other grotesque ailments or symptoms. That's how you pass away. Because it's quite a slow-moving disease, keep it slow-moving and see how we get. We have to moderate the medicine from time to time because the downside of the medicine for Parkinson's, the side effects can be worrying. A few months ago, I was walking in our local high street, and there was a family walking towards me, a family of four or five, and they had this cute little dog, like a long-haired Dachshund, I think it was. And I looked down, and I looked at them, and looked back, and I said, "I love your dog." And he said, "What dog?" And I looked down, and there was no dog to be seen the second time. So the hallucinations or something. I've imagined people in the road, where I've been as close as I am to you now, where I say hello, and I look again, and they're not there. It's really wild. It's like taking some sort of drug for fun, which I never would. I'm not scared by it. I just, now that I know that the hallucinations are there, I try to moderate the dosages. But that's where I am now. I've got an excellent neurologist, but I do Tai Chi now a couple of times a week, and that really has helped a lot, the aerobics as well, even walking a lot, which I do. I carry on. Some days I get shakes, some days I don't, but I'm not embarrassed of if they happen, and just carry on. I've read lots. You're not alone. There's Parkinson's UK, which is the main charity-raising effort for Parkinson's people. That's been very helpful. And I try not to think too negatively. The idea of death doesn't scare me in the slightest. Funnily enough, I'm not bothered about that. But I am bothered about the pain that might come with it, or the sadness that the family would feel. I don't want anybody to be sad or anything like that. But, so I'm not worried about that the way I initially was, because I thought, you know, how long have I got? I decided that I wanted to come out because I was living a lie to my friends and family. I was told by the doctor, best way to handle this, he says, just don't tell anyone that you've got it. What about my family, my wife? She said, don't tell anybody, nobody. He said, you'll get people all the time asking you how you feel. And I said, I wouldn't be bothered about that. He said, you will. And in fact, I'm still not bothered by it. I like it. People in Waitrose or wherever I am to say, how are you doing? They've read about it. And when I go to events, either with through the charity or just walking in the supermarket, and people talk about it, and people are always pleased to see me and hear me talk about Parkinson's, because it's quite common, and a lot more people are going to get it. I was probably happiest in my career when I was working with John Peel doing the evening show, because it was, I mean, he would come in an hour before he needed to sit and chat about everything and anything when I was in the studio, and I would likewise stay on and talk to him in his studio. So it was a good pal for me in the studio, and he was great company. A few weeks before he died, he was showing me this needle that he was administering to himself because he had suffered from diabetes. And he was coping okay with that. So, well, as much as he did. I used to think I was a hypochondriac, but he used to be 10 times worse. He would compare symptoms about almost anything. I'd like to be remembered as someone who came from a modest background, who went on through just doing something he loved, radio, was able to make a life's career out of it, because these days there are few jobs that are for life. But I've managed to be asked to join more stations than I've left, and it's a triumph of the little guy, I guess, against the big guys.
David Jensen. For more in this series, follow the Radio Moments Conversations podcast.